CNBC reported 2 weeks ago that Peter Navarro was internally fighting this phase one deal and that he believed that no tariffs should be rolled back if China didn't commit to the original language on intellectual property.
They'd like to have a rollback. I haven't agreed to anything. China would like to get somewhat of a rollback, not a complete rollback, because they know I won't do it.
Currently, a burden on small and medium-sized businesses that is not felt by larger companies in America, so that hiring is actually tougher for them in many cases.
Well, I think, first of all, I think we are slightly accommodative, and that's fine. I don't think that our position now is likely to spark the economy to get into an overheated mode where we might expect there to be some weakening in response to that. I worry a lot about the policy space that we have. We are at a half to three, 1¾. That's not a lot of space. When you think historically what responses have been in the recessionary to a recession, we don't have that much space.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
What a week it was for the markets this week. All the major indexes up in record territory. And more importantly, it's not just large caps. It's mid caps and small caps also rising as well. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me on the program will be Richard Dixon from Lowry's, and he said everything is pointing to this market heading higher. Buying pressure is increasing, selling pressure is decreasing, and the advanced decline line is supporting it. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. If you've been sitting on the sidelines, you might want to rethink that. Also, later on in the program, Robert Rapier will be joining us as we talk about the Aramco IPO supposed to go public, or at least they're going to announce the valuation this weekend. We'll take a look at everybody's talking about an energy glut next year. Is that a possibility? And where you should invest in energy. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. And then a special edition of The Big Picture. We're going to take a look at a 120-page report issued by Morgan Stanley about the elections next year. Elections have consequences, and we'll be talking about that. All of that coming up in today's program.
We welcome Ryan Poplava back into the studio this week. But before we go into this week, let me just recap some of the things that you said, Ryan, last week, because it seems like those were pivotal catalysts that led the market to the recent all-time highs that we're seeing in the last 2 weeks. So you said there were two big plays last week. The first was the Federal Reserve meeting, in which they cut 25 basis points. And through the policy statement and Powell's press conference, the Fed has said that there is a high bar to lower rates as well as a high bar to raise rates. The Fed thinks policy is appropriate, and investors seem to agree, as the probability of a December cut is now in the single digits. Now, the other item last week was the jobs report and the ISM manufacturing report, which communicated that we have slow growth, but no recession. And then these two items, an accommodative Fed and slow growth, have led to stock market gains in the past under similar conditions and is being construed again now. So it seems this week is mainly playing off those two catalysts and awaiting the next.
That summarized the gist of things, I think. Looking at the momentum from those catalysts last week, I think that's, you know, carrying forward into this week. A fear of missing out always is something that a lot of are talking about. And why are we talking about a fear of missing out? Who's missing out? You know, Chris, there was actually a Lipper report on Wednesday that money market funds sit at a 10-year high of $3.4 trillion. And I think Chris Poplava has been on the show a couple of times. We talk about it in-house here about the fund flows. You know, where are funds going, looking at the different mutual funds and ETFs? And it's been clearly bonds for several months now. So if you look at those two things, that really tells you why there may be a case that the high cash positioning has led to higher prices, as, you know, you get a lot of money managers, investors, they're buying the dips. So we had some trade drama And uncertainty as we got closer to the signing of a phase one deal, each side still continued to play their politics to move things more in their favor. We've seen this before. You know, the beginning of the week, Commerce Secretary Ross said licenses for the U.S. companies to do business with Huawei should be coming. And he also had positive things to say about the phase one deal progressing well, and even something new saying that the U.S. may not have to impose tariff hikes on foreign car imports. So looking at those items on Monday, that helped propel things even further after the great gains we had on Friday. And equities got a nice lift on that news. Now, the rest of the week, however, had some doubt and uncertainty begin to creep in. You know, possibly a sense that the market had risen too much on hope of the deal. It's not set on, autopilot just yet. So Tuesday, there was a report that the U.S. is considering rolling back the September 1 tariff and blocking the December 15th consumer goods tariff that was postponed. China press reports on the same day were confirming this line of thinking that they want more tariffs removed for phase one to happen, to even happen. They want to see actual tariffs removed, besides merely just the delay that we've seen them agree to. To recap, the phase one agreement so far has only been a delay of the October 15th tariff, which was actually a delay of the October 1 tariff. Anyways, you know, there was an intended increase on tariffs to 30% from 25% on around 250 billion of Chinese goods, roughly about half of the tariffs that we have in place right now. Now, I know there are so many tariffs now, it's really hard to keep them all straight. So, again, I just wanted to talk about, you know, where things are at right now. And what hasn't been removed yet is the impending December 15th consumer goods tariff of 15%. And now that's going to be affecting several that have kind of avoided most of the tariffs up to this point because they're on heavily consumer-oriented goods, you know, laptops, maybe the Apple iPhone, et cetera. That's a big deal. There were a few articles throughout the week that there would need to be more tariff cuts for a phase one to even happen. You know, there were reports that China Commerce Ministry said the U.S. and Chinese have already agreed that it's already given a case that they're going to be canceling, not postponing, canceling existing tariffs. And then Friday, Trump made it crystal clear that he has not agreed to roll back any existing tariffs. And they'd said the same thing at the phase one agreement as well. So clearly some political maneuvering is still going on for phase one, while investors had already maybe begin propping up cyclical stocks up on the presumption it was a done deal. So buy the rumor, sell the news. That's what we tend to see in the stock market. And in summary, we've applied tariffs on 550 billion of goods, while the Chinese have applied tariffs on 185 billion.
Well, Ryan, is there anything that investors should be concerned about? Or would you say this is just market off to the races like it did in 2013 and even 2017 after we saw similar sideways consolidations that, if I remember correctly, took 1 to 2 years to resolve?
Well, from a technical standpoint, I don't think there's a single technician that we can have on our show that says this isn't, you know, a great thing to see. In addition to seeing the cyclicals performing well, you know, there's a lot of areas that weren't working in the market. They're starting to work now, financials, et cetera. Like I interviewed Craig Jones a couple of weeks ago, said the very same thing. So we may be off to the races. And I know that from a technical standpoint, it's phenomenal when you got new highs and there's nothing above you saying, hey, previous seller sold here and probably wants to buy back. So anyways, one issue I was talking about to Rob Bernard recently in our office was, and he's one of our independent reps, about seeing these cyclical and mostly multinational companies go up in value due to encouraging global PMI data. Chris has shared that. We've shared that with our clients in our newsletter as well. And the one thing that will not help them is a strong dollar. That's what Rob was pointing out. The euro recently has resumed its slide since the Fed basically said they're done for the time being. They're done cutting. So while if we look at other central banks, they're stepping up the accommodation gas pedal. So the strength in the dollar can also be contributed to technical support near its 200-day moving average. Craig Johnson pointed that out. And then also economic data has improved just a hair, but it has. And like manufacturing last week, snapping a 6-month downtrend, the ISM services data this week ticked up in October to a reading of 54.7 from 52.6. So a nice tick up there, not really removing the downtrend or the deceleration that we've seen, but you know, it is definitely a good sign. While we're also on board the risk on movement, you know, we're conscientious that a big drop in the dollar is needed for the likes of the large cap multinationals to really continue to outperform beyond just, you know, is global trade going to improve, especially the US and China. But a trade agreement and an improvement to that outlook, definitely the biggest contributor and why we're in those areas. So we continue to watch the smaller cap stocks, you know, very closely to see if they can begin to outperform. You know, we haven't had exposure there for at least a year. We did try in the first part of the year. And then there's the larger allocation of financial institutions, which are also in those smaller cap stocks. You also don't find large multinationals. So we figured, hey, you know, if the multinationals don't work out, if the dollar strengthens substantially, then let's look towards those small caps again. But we're not seeing that relationship change yet. Still, it seems like most investors prefer to be in those large cap areas. And maybe it's because they just want to buy what they know. I've only highlighted a little of the current earnings season, but as of the latest FactSet data from November 8th, and I think this is kind of important because we've only really talked about it at the beginning of the season, about 89% of the S&P 500 companies have reported earnings, Chris, and about 3.8% of that is above estimates. So we're beating estimates by around 3.8%, but that's below the five-year average. And when you look at the earnings from these companies that reported, as well as the estimates from the 11% that still have not, so we take their estimates with the ones that have reported, we call that a blended earnings guidance there. And that's showing that we've got still a decline this quarter, year over year, around 2.4%. Now it's the decline has shrunk, but it's still there, and it's the third consecutive quarter of declines. And now I'm seeing estimates now for the fourth quarter now dipping into negative territory. So that's not good. The last time that happened was from, I forget when in 2015, but basically ended the second quarter of 2016. What did we see happen at that time? The stock market corrected 10 to 15% twice, although most of that was correlated to headlines with the yuan revaluation there. But the current price earnings ratio on the S&P 500 should probably know that, about 17.4, which is above the five-year average and the 10-year average. I'm not saying we're overvalued, but we're not cheap yet either.
Well, all in all, Brian, it sounds like good news, and hopefully the market continues its upward climb. In the meantime, we do want to thank you for stopping by the studio, and we'll look forward to hearing from you next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
This week, we had a very interesting conversation with Jim Bianco at Bianco Research. A number of things that we discussed is whether or not we're seeing a reacceleration in the global economic data, what the recent print from jobs numbers and also the manufacturing side are telling us about the narrative when we think about, hey, are we looking at signs of recession? What's happening with the repo market and the Fed? Are they adding stimulus or not? So lots of interesting things that we discussed with Jim this week. Here is a clip of what he had to say.
Maybe the story is there's something else going on here besides, trade's holding everything back. If they could only get Trump and Xi together and shake hands and sign a piece of paper, all of this would go away. I understand that argument, but what I'm afraid the markets might be signaling to us, there's something else there. You're going to get them to shake hands, smile, sign a piece of paper, and then you're going to look at the markets a week, 2 weeks, a month later and go, it didn't change anything. And that's going to be what I think is going to be the real shock for everybody, because we're so invested in this idea that it's all about trade. And if we could just get that and maybe Brexit off the table, then we wind up with everything going back to being like it was in 2017.
So if you'd like to listen to this full interview and aren't already a subscriber to FS Insider, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
Did you know that municipal bonds can provide you with a predictable source of income that is free from both federal and state income taxes? If you're in a high tax bracket, municipal bonds could be the right investment choice for you. If you have more than $500,000 to invest, our portfolio managers can create a municipal bond portfolio designed to align with your financial goals. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 now and add tax-free bonds to your portfolio. That's 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, this has been a good week for investors. We're getting a bit of a pullback on Friday, but stocks remain in record territory. Will that continue to the end of the year with the Santa Claus rally, or is a correction around the corner? Joining us from Lowry's Research is Richard Dixon. Richard, let's begin as we always do. You have two measures that you use to judge the health of the market. That's buying pressure and selling pressure. Let's discuss both.
Well, as things stand right now, you're seeing a very nice expansion in demand as measured by the buying power index and contraction in supply as measured by the selling pressure index. As a matter of fact, the spread between the two, which is a measure that we use to really indicate the balance of supply and demand, is the most positive it's been since, actually it's a little bit more positive than it was at the July high in the market. So, as far as this rally, particularly since the October 2nd low, that little minor low we had in the market, is being well supported by a rising demand and falling supply. About the best you can hope for.
And how would you contrast that since the beginning of the year? Has that been pretty much the case, Richard, throughout this rally all year long?
Well, you did have a period, initially, obviously, off the December low, you had a very rapid rise in demand and a very rapid fall in supply. That normally happens when you come off a significant market low. And starting about in April, you started to see a little bit of a drop-off in demand and a rise in supply that actually preceded the actual high in the S&P. Things bottomed at that January 4th low. And since then, things really have been moving along just fine. So, are things as high as they were, for instance, back in April? No, they're not. But at the same time, the trends are what you hope to see, which is for a rising trend in buying and a dropping trend in supply. So, really, as far as these two measures are concerned, the market seems to be firing on all cylinders right now.
There's another indicator that you guys use. It's advanced decline line minus, a lot of the income-oriented things like bond funds. What does that look like? Is that supporting your buying and selling pressure indicators?
Absolutely. Most positive indication of, expanding breadth supporting a rally is when you have both the New York All Issues advanced decline line and the operating companies only advanced decline line making new highs at the same time. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. New York for a while was leading the OCO. That was when you were seeing, for instance, 10-year was dropping down about 1.5%. But over the last, month, the two of them have been moving right along together, making new highs. As a matter of fact, they were leading in making new highs. They were leading the price indexes. And that has historically been a good sign. And we were saying at the time that those new highs suggested that you were going to see new highs. And this is back in August and September, that you were going to see new highs in the market. And obviously, that's what's happened.
And Richard, do you guys track the different sectors in the S&P in terms of buying and selling pressure?
We do not. We don't break it down into segments. What we do break down into segments is things like the advanced decline lines for the S&P 500, 400 mid-cap, and the 600 small-cap. And we also look at things like the percentage of stocks that are down 20% or more from their highs. We do that on a segmented basis, and also stocks that are at or within 2% of their highs on a segmented basis for our operating companies only measures. So, and again, those have been acting very well. As a matter of fact, when you look at the number of new highs, you might say, well, it seems to be lagging a little bit. It's not as high as it was back in July, for instance, but it's high as it's been since then. And what's interesting is that the segment that seems to be lagging right now is the large cap segment, the number of stocks, the percentage of stocks at or within 2% of their highs. The small caps actually are higher than they were back in July. And that's sort of the opposite of what you'd expect to see if you're looking at an aging bull market, where you generally see that kind of lag deterioration in strength starting in the small caps. Well, right now, it's flipped on its head, where the small caps and mid caps are actually outperforming large caps. So that would suggest you're seeing somewhat of a rejuvenation in the market. It may in part be due to some cycling into areas of the market that had been down. You obviously have seen strength in things like basic materials, financials, industrials, and whereas some of those have been lagging, say in the second or third quarter this year, now they're starting to take a leading role, and that has helped, I think, particularly the lagger in the small caps to really outperform the large caps. So again, that's another good sign for the market.
So unlike last year, I mean, if we go back to this time last year, the markets were breaking down. Of course, the Fed was raising interest rates back then. This time they're lowering interest rates. So you don't see anything in the indicators that you're following that would alert you to the kind of a downturn that we had in the fourth quarter last year.
No, as a matter of fact, we've written several reports on exactly that topic. The differences between what you're seeing today and what you saw, for instance, late in the third quarter, early in the fourth quarter last year, there are just no similarities. You're not seeing any kind of lag in breadth. You're not seeing a poor performance in the buy power selling pressure indexes. You know, there's really nothing that you can hang your hat on to say, oh, yeah, here's some signs that suggest maybe we're going to see some kind of a significant decline in the fourth quarter. To the contrary, everything's to be disgustingly healthy right now for the market.
You know, when you talk about buying pressure is increasing, selling pressure is decreasing, advanced decline line for operating companies, that's advancing, that's supporting. When all things are pointing in one direction, I guess maybe we could look for a higher price. Do we get that Santa Claus rally that typically we get seasonality-wise this time of the year?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, short term, yes, we are seeing some signs. You know, there's some signs of selectivity, and obviously in terms of some of the price momentum indicators, you're sort of getting up in levels where you've had pullbacks before. So it's possible we could get some kind of a short-term pullback. But it's within the context of a dominant trend right now, which is up. And without any signs of real deterioration in that dominant trend, like you had, for instance, last September, probabilities are that any kind of a counter trend move, short-term pullback, if you will, is going to be pretty minor and really of interest only to the shortest-term traders. What has been interesting about this market is that we have seen these short-term signs for the last couple of weeks. It's been overbought readings and these momentum indicators. There's nothing new. It's been overbought for a while. We've seen signs of selectivity, for instance, the percent of stocks above their 10-day moving averages, above their 30-day moving averages, and they've not confirmed these highs that we've been setting in the market over the last couple of weeks. Generally, those are an indication of saying, okay, you know, be careful in here. You're going to see a pullback. What has been notable is really the lack of selling. There really has been very, very little selling. Demand may have dried up a little bit, and you know, you've had some little hiccups, very minor hiccups the last couple of weeks. But overall, and despite the very heavy volume that we've had, we've been averaging more, over 4 billion shares for the past five or six sessions in the market, there has been really no significant rise in selling. And you know, that, again, is a sign of a strong trend. And that doesn't mean you can't see a pullback, but it suggests that even though you've had those signs of a potential top, it still has not generated any kind of significant selling. Today's another example. You know, in the absence of selling, you're not talking about any kind of a significant pullback for the market.
You know, it's been amazing, Richard. I mean, there's been a lot of headline-driven days in the markets, whether it's a presidential tweet on the trade wars or it's impeachment, but it doesn't seem like anything seems to phase this market, and that just goes to show you how strong this trend is. Whether it's impeachment, whether it's, you know, something comes out on the trade, maybe you get a down day for a day or two, but it doesn't stay there.
Again, you look at the underlying forces of supply and demand in the market, and they're still strong. So, you know, that would argue that any kind of pullback is likely to be met fairly quickly with renewed demand, particularly if the supply never really picks up.
I wonder if you might just discuss the type of things you typically see at a market top, because I don't see any of that right now. Do you?
Well, historically, you know, market tops are not going to be identical, but they tend to share characteristics. One, generally, you will see some signs of deteriorating breadth, normally starting with small cap stocks. But as we mentioned earlier, small caps, if anything, are showing more strength right now, particularly as far as, you know, things like the advanced decline lines, percent of stocks close to their, at or within 2% of their highs. You know, so, you know, there's nothing there. But you would normally expect to see some kind of a deterioration in breadth. In other words, a divergence in the advanced decline lines. The market is making new highs. The advanced decline lines are not. Clearly, that is not the case. Market, if anything, advanced decline lines have been leading the price indexes higher. So there's nothing there. The other thing that we normally would be watching for is some indication of rising supply. Investors take more and more profit taking, and they find fewer and fewer stocks that are at values that appear justified in new buying, but but more and more stocks that appear to be overvalued and call for profit taking. We're not seeing that. I mean, obviously, buying power, as we talked about, is going up, selling pressure is going down. So, you know, that increase in profit taking historically has resulted in an uptrend and in a sustained uptrend, something that lasts months, not days or weeks, in selling pressure. That's not happening. There has been no corresponding drop off in buying power. Buying power has been steady, and just now recently it's just made new recovery highs. So, you know, the underlying forces that generally show the deterioration, they suggest, okay, this market is showing signs that it's getting tired enough so that we can expect to see some kind of a final market top and then a bear market. None of those are present right now.
It's just absolutely amazing. I read two articles this week that pension funds all across the country are increasing their weight to equities in order to achieve their goals for their retirees. And then I read another article that you have record amounts of cash by individual investors on the sideline, indicating that there's plenty of fuel left to drive this market higher. And Richard, what you're telling me, buying pressure is increasing, selling pressure is decreasing, your advanced decline line. I mean, small caps, mid caps are marching forward too. So it seems to me all systems go ahead.
That's basically it. I mean, we keep looking at this market. We probably could argue, did you see, some people will say, well, you had a bear market bottom in December of last year, and this is a new bull market. My response to that is, that in order to have a bear market, you first need to have signs of a major market top, and you did not have those signs in September last year. And so all we had, by our analysis at least, was a very deep correction, a 20% drop, similar to the 19.8 or 9% drop you had in 2011. So, you know, by our measures, this is still a bear market, still a bull market that started in March of 2009. So, you know, we're working now on 11 years. For a bull market, you know, you could argue, I guess, and say that you started a bull market in what, October of 1990, and you know, you lasted until March of 2000. Well, this is even longer than that. So, you know, it's amazing that rather than really showing signs of age, it seems like we see signs of renewal. You know, like small caps have been lagging. Now small caps are, you know, have improved. You know, there are no signs of any kind of divergences in the advanced decline lines. There's no signs of real deterioration in demand in the market, or it's obviously in rising supply. There's nothing there. And that's the amazing thing. You know, you sort of sit, look at it and say, there's got to be something. But, you know, there may well be, but it's not within the limits of what we look at. And, you know, what we've been looking at has seemed to work pretty well since 1938 when Mr. Lowry started this service. So, you know, we have to say the probabilities are that, no, in fact, this market is still healthy.
So, Richard, what would you tell investors if they've been sitting on the sidelines, number one, or number two, those that are fully invested? I suspect you would tell them, if you're fully invested or invested, stay there. If you're on the sidelines, you might want to put some money to work.
Yeah. You know, I was just talking with someone who was fully invested a couple of days ago, and he was a little bit concerned about the market, talked about raising cash a little bit. And I said, well, fine, if that's what makes you comfortable. But, you know, if you're doing anything at all at this point, it would be to take a look at your portfolio. What stocks are lagging? You know, what are not fully participating in this rally? Those would be candidates to say, okay, if I want to raise some cash or if I want to reposition, those would be candidates for selling. And then it's up to you. Do you want to leave it in cash? Do you want to reposition it into, say, some of your strongest stocks? But that's about it. You know, there's really no reason at this point in time to be thinking about selling, you know, other than, as I said, to, you know, sort of restructure your portfolio, maybe strengthen your portfolio. For people who are sitting on the sidelines, I would say the same thing that we were talking about back in December when we started off the lows. Don't wait for a pullback. Get in the market. We know it's up, but the probabilities are that by the time you get a pullback, the pullback will be at a higher level than where you are right now. So you haven't accomplished anything by waiting. And I think the same would apply right now, that if you're waiting for that big pullback, and certainly if you're, you know, saying, well, I'm waiting for that bear market, you may still have a long wait. So, you know, it'd be a better idea to put some money to work.
All right. Well, listen, Richard, as we close, tell our listeners how they can find out more about the information that you guys do. As you mentioned, you guys have been around since, what, 1938 and have calling these markets successfully. How could they find out more information about you?
Easiest way is just to Google Lowry Research. It's L-O-W-R-Y. We're not the spice company, so leave the E out. W-L-R-Y Research, and that will take you to our website. And from there, you have several options as to, you know, trials for the various levels of service that we offer. You'll find out something about the company, about the people who work here, and you can go from there.
All right. Well, listen, Richard, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have yourself a great weekend and a happy holiday.
Thanks very much, Jim. You too.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
The Fed has been injecting hundreds of billions of dollars into the market ever since short-term borrowing rates in the so-called repo market saw an unusual spike around 2 months ago in mid-September from 2% to as high as 10%. This has been a source of major discussion by analysts and market watchers, with some warning that this may be the start of something bigger. Joining us on the show today is Martin Armstrong at armstrongeconomics.com. Martin, I want to ask you about your take on the repo market, specifically because I know that you addressed this in your recent World Economic Conference in Orlando. I believe this was a big topic of discussion. What is your take on what's happening here? And does the Fed have the tools to address the funding issues in the repo market?
What's really happening is that banks no longer trust banks. So what's happening is that nobody knows who has what. And the real crisis is not the United States, it's in Europe. What's happening is that instead of Lehman, they're very concerned that this is going to be a Deutsche Bank moment.
To hear this full interview with the legendary forecaster and market strategist Martin Armstrong to get his take on the emerging repo crisis, just go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe.
Well, the one good news for consumers this year, unless you live in California, is energy prices have moderated. They're now in the mid-50s, and they seem to be staying there. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, I want to begin with a couple issues on energy and take this in a different path today. Let's begin with the IPO of Aramco, which is, if it comes out anywhere near what they expect it to be, could be the biggest IPO in history. I know the Crown Prince is looking at a $2 trillion valuation. The bankers are saying maybe one and a half.
Yeah, and I think the bankers are probably right, and they may be optimistic. The worst enemy for Aramco over the last 10 years has been U.S. shale. That has really hurt the Aramco IPO. They probably would have gotten $2 trillion had, you know, U.S. shale not knocked oil prices down, and basically it keeps expanding, and that is keeping pressure on oil prices, and that is going to hurt the Aramco IPO. There's no telling what Aramco could have gotten had they remained in control of oil prices the way they were 2006, 2007.
You know, it's interesting because today on oil price, there's an article, is OPEC losing its influence? Do you believe that to be the case, especially with U.S. shale? I mean, who would have thought 4 or 5 years ago the U.S. would become the number one oil producer in the world?
Right. I mean, yes, OPEC is losing its influence. However, they still have a lot of influence. I mean, they still produce 40% of the world's oil. It's just that as U.S. oil production keeps expanding, and it's continued to do so, you know, OPEC is finding that they're having to cut production and cut production. They're kind of in a no-win situation. You know, if they hold production or expand production, they're going to crash the oil price. The only way they can prop up oil prices is to cut production, but that helps U.S. shale producers as well, because that helps keep oil prices propped up. But, you know, they've already tried to expand production and crash prices. They did that in 2014. That didn't work very well because they didn't put enough shale producers out of business. And so they're still paying for that decision today. If they had started to cut oil production back, I think, in 2014, we would probably have seen oil prices remain propped up in the $75 to $100 range instead of where they are now.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading the IPO, and they're anticipating paying a $75 billion dividend, which would equate to 5%, which would be equivalent to some of the big majors like Exxon, Total, and some of the other companies. But the interesting thing about it, Robert, if I was an investor, why would I invest in Aramco? Because if you look at the terms of the deal, as the price of oil goes up, the percentage take by the government increases. So there's kind of a limit to the upside on oil, because if oil prices go up, the government take goes up.
Yeah, there are definitely some special risks. Novice investors should not go buy Aramco stock. There, you have a lot safer options and really good dividends in a lot of different U.S. companies, U.S.-based companies, where you don't have sort of the geopolitical risk and the government risk and so forth. So I would be very hesitant myself to buy that IPO.
You know, one of the interesting things, and let's talk about American shale, is the year-over-year growth in increase in shale is slowing down dramatically because, you know, what happens is an increase last year, I think it got up close to 12 million barrels. And then, you know, what the EIA and the other agencies tend to do is they tend to extrapolate that going forward. It's slowing down. Has shale production, is it peaking because the rig count has gone down? A lot of the newer wells are what they call baby wells. So, you know, they tend to produce a lot more in the first couple months, but then the decline rate is increasing, or the depletion rate.
So back in the summer, it looked very much like shale was slowing down. I plotted the year-over-year change in oil production, and it was definitely slowing down in the summer, and it had been slowing down from January until about July. And since then, it has picked back up some. I'm looking at the production numbers right now from the EIA. The current week, which was a week ago, 12.6 million barrels a day of domestic production. That is 1.4 million barrels a day higher than a year ago. That's pretty substantial year-over-year increase. Back in the summer, that increase was much lower than that. So it looks like things have picked back up a bit. I mean, you are right that some of the new wells are not producing what the legacy well production are, because you're getting out into some of the less optimal real estate. But they're also, and the drilling count is falling. As you say, the rig count is falling. However, there are like 8,000 drilled but uncompleted wells out there. That's wells that have been drilled but haven't been fracked yet. It's like money in the bank. They're sitting there waiting. So even if the rig count fell to zero today, they'd still be able to go ahead and frack those wells. So there's quite a bit of inventory there. So eventually, as the rig count falls, I mean, you will see production start to, you know, slow down and tail off. But with all that big drilled but uncompleted inventory, all those wells, there's going to be a bit of a lag. I mean, once the rig count falls, you're going to see a bit of a lag in a relation between the oil production and the rig count. It's going to be a little bit delayed.
Now, a lot of the analysts are predicting an oil glut for 2020. A lot of that's based on present Saudi production, OPEC production, and a continued increase in shale production. Do you see a glut forming in 2020?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, so I've looked at the IEA numbers. The IEA is predicting a deficit in the second half of this year, and that's partially because of the attacks in Saudi took some production offline, substantial amount of production offline, and they expect some draw on inventories. But then for the first half of next year, they're actually predicting a slowdown in demand, and they're predicting that supply is going to continue to steadily advance. So they show a bit of a deficit in the second half of next year, but a surplus of oil in the first half. So at least the IEA, and I think OPEC as well, and OPEC cited a slowdown in the overall economy as slowing down demand a little bit. And so OPEC, and I know the IEA are projecting a surplus next year. So it's highly possible that will happen.
Let's talk about some of these companies that are producing shale, because if you take a look at the junk bond market, it tends to be heavily populated with energy companies. Wall Street is getting stingy on refinancing, and a lot of these companies just been reporting terrible numbers. Robert, it seems like the only people that are making money in that area tends to be the big guys like your Exxons, your Shells, and Chevrons, which have moved into this space.
Right. And I would add ConocoPhillips to that. I mean, ConocoPhillips has my former employer. They've they have positioned themselves to make money at $50 oil. And so they're reporting pretty good numbers. And a lot of the guys that have been around through many of these cycles, you know, they go out and they overextend themselves thinking, you know, well, we'll break even when oil prices get to $60 or $70 a barrel. And the longer they hang around at, you know, 50, 60 range, the more financial trouble those guys get into. And, you know, ironically, it's OPEC that could bail them out. OPEC can bail them out by cutting production and boosting oil prices some. And that's, again, that's the dilemma that OPEC has. Do we keep production down and help these guys out? Or do we boost production and put these guys out of business while at the same time hurting our bottom line for some short term in hopes that in the long run, we'll have our market share back and oil prices will be higher?
Well, it goes to show you how much the world has changed, because when that Saudi oil facility got taken out, roughly 5% of the world's oil production. Boy, Robert, if that would have happened 10 years ago, God knows how high the price of oil would have gone. But we got a spike for a couple of days and things went back to normal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If if you go back to 2007, 2008, when oil prices were running up to $100, we didn't have all this spare U.S. shale production. We didn't have all these barrels being added to the world market. And you could have easily seen $200 oil. I actually expected prices to hang in above where they are right now. I didn't expect them to return back to normal so quickly. There should be a bit of a geopolitical premium on oil prices now, considering, you know, the ease with which they pulled that attack off. But the market has totally discounted that. I think the market has said, you know, we're not worried about Saudi oil, you know, being taken offline.
Well, let's move in another direction. You recently wrote an article about this lawsuit that's being brought up against Exxon on climate change. Let's get into that a bit, and I'd like to hear your views on it, because it was based on a comment of one of their scientists. And Robert, you worked for an oil company. You did a lot of research. People don't understand that with a lot of these oil companies, they have an environmental department. These are people that are trying to make sure that what the oil company does follows environmental guidelines. And then also, people don't understand that a lot of these big energy companies like Exxon was into solar in the 70s.
Right. And so I think here is what the average person thinks of when they, you know, you see these signs, Exxon knew. What they believe is Exxon stumbled onto this, you know, this relationship between carbon dioxide emissions and climate change back in the 70s. And they said, oh my gosh, we can never let the public find out about this. We have to hide this and cover it up. And I've spoken to many people who believe that that is the case. Now, speaking as someone who's worked inside the oil industry, I think what's more likely happened is, you know, the scientists presented their views and management, some management heard them and they said, okay, well, that's very interesting. They don't have 40 years of hindsight like we do to look back and go, well, it should have been obvious to you. Keep in mind that this was not consensus, overwhelming scientific consensus that we have today. This was 40 years ago when they were still debating whether aerosols in the air were going to lead to a period of global cooling. And there were a lot of mainstream news articles about global cooling. So, you know, we look at this issue today and we say, well, Exxon knew. Well, in reality, I've presented my findings to management before and management didn't agree. They said, you know, I hear you. Now, that doesn't mean that the company knew. Whatever I presented to them, management heard it. They may not have agreed. They may not have thought it was a pressing issue. They may have said, let's wait and see how this develops. That doesn't mean that, you know, some scientist presents his views that suddenly the company as a whole, they know about this issue and they're suddenly trying to cover it up. And I think that is the impression that people have. That's why they're being sued, because people think that they sat on this issue, you know, in 1977, you know, the light bulb clicked on and they saw it and they've spent all this time covering it up. Now, you can argue that they've done things in the interim. You know, they funded groups that say climate change is not a thing. And I've tried to tell people, I said, rightly or wrongly, oil industry is very conservative. And when I went to work for ConocoPhillips and I would try to talk to somebody about climate change, they would look at me like I was crazy. They would say, you know, this is a hoax. So they are funding groups sometimes, but this sometimes comes from a sincere belief that, you know, this is not happening. Climate change is not happening. It's not necessarily that they're trying to cover something up. They have this sincere belief. And we can say, well, your belief was wrong, But it comes from a place that people don't understand, the place it comes from. I sincerely believe this. I'm funding these groups because I believe that this is correct.
Well, it's interesting because the views on climate change have changed over the last 40 years. As you mentioned, when this was first brought up at Exxon, I know when I was going to college, it was global cooling. We were going into an ice age, which turned out not to be the case. Then it became global warming, and then it warmed for a while, then it changed. So now it's just called climate change. So the views about the environment have changed dramatically over the last 40 years.
Yeah, and I think there's we have a better understanding now. I mean, there's no question that 40 years ago, it was understood that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas, and it was understood the relationship by which carbon dioxide could warm up the atmosphere. But it was, at the same time, there were aerosols that were being emitted that were causing some rays to be reflected. And how big of an impact was that going to have? So again, today we have this, we can look back 40 years and we can see that fossil fuel consumption globally has more than doubled in that time. And we can see, okay, it's a bigger issue today. There's more scientific consensus today. We saw how things evolved over that time, but it's asking a bit much to expect that ExxonMobil in real time in 1977 could see how all this was going to unfold.
So given where we are today, there is a possibility that we could have more oil next year, depending on what happens to economic growth. Although on the positive side, we're seeing our global LEI start to bottom. So that consensus can change too. Given the difficulty that a lot of these companies are struggling with, they're basically not making money in the shale patch. If you were an oil investor, Robert, would you stay with the big guys at this point?
Yeah, if you want to be safe, I'd stay with the big guys. I mean, I look across usually, upstream, midstream, downstream and see, where's the value? A year ago, last December, I said refining is the value right now. I recommended Valero. It's up more than 40% since then. Refining is pretty fully valued at this point, so I don't see any value there. I see value in midstream, the pipeline companies. I see value in the oil producers, but you may have to be a bit patient there. I think the oil producers are still going to suffer, for a while, especially the small guys. I mean, it's a risky bet on some of these smaller players. I think the ConocoPhillips of the world, I think they'll do very well. I think the midstream companies like Enterprise Products and Magellan, those Plains All America, they're going to do very well. But they've gotten hit pretty hard over the last, couple of months. They had a good first half of the year, but they've sold off since then. But if you look, their cash flow is increasing, their distribution coverage is increasing. Fundamentally, they look pretty good, but they've sold off with the weakness in the overall energy sector. So I think the biggest value right now is probably in midstream and, a little bit longer term. If you pick up some of those, oil companies, I think like ConocoPhillips and some of them that are generating enough cash flow right now at $50 oil, that they're not having to take on debt to survive.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, you're a prolific writer. You write for several newspapers and magazines. If our listeners would like to follow you, and you also publish your own newsletter, tell them how they can find out more about what the things you write about.
So I write 7 columns a month for Forbes, that usually one on a Sunday evening and one on Thursday morning or something like that. Generally covering overall energy space, and that may be oil, it may be solar, there's nuclear, all kinds of things. I also write for Investing Daily. I have a monthly newsletter called Utility Forecaster, where I cover the utility space, but also other income-producing investments like MLPs, like Enterprise Products and, real estate investment trusts. And then I write a free column for Investing Daily every Tuesday, and you can find that on their homepage. And that's just personal finance stuff. It's, looking at the general economy and certain sectors. That's, for example, this week I wrote travel tips for the holidays. I just saved $1,000 on airline tickets, and I said, here are some of the tricks you should know. So it's just general investment or general personal finance knowledge to, maybe put a little more money in your pocket.
Okay, Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Always a pleasure to have you here. You have a great weekend.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Morgan Stanley published a report, a research report that's over 120 pages. It's called 2020 Vision, an early guide to the U.S. election. With the presidential election happening in less than 1 year, Jim, I feel it's appropriate for us to go into this report. It is obviously exhaustive, but it seems to do a fair job of talking about how investors are approaching this election, pros and cons of different candidates, pros and cons of different initiatives from those candidates. And I noticed here in this report, Jim, I mean, in terms of policy outcomes, executive authority, policy transformation, it seems to all be in this report.
It's pretty comprehensive, and the gist of it is they have five takeaways, and we're going to get into each one of them. And those takeaways are, number one, elections have consequences, and especially in the 2020 election, because you're talking about two different, entirely opposed economic philosophies in terms of running the economy. Number two, it says they believe reactive is better than proactive. In other words, what they're trying to say here, Chris, if you're trying to predict what the outcome is going to be and position your portfolio, that's probably not going to work out too well. Just look at the way the 2016 elections have turned out. There have been a lot of elections that have turned out much differently than the polls. And so they're saying you're better off being reactive to what the outcome would be rather than proactive, because nobody's that smart. Number three, they're also saying a lot of these policy ambitions, if whatever candidate gets elected, if Trump gets reelected or it's Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you can forget about everything they tell you they're going to do in the election to get elected, because it's probably going to be impossible to get a lot of those things implemented. Because as they point out, typically the president, and especially a new president, they may get one or two key items on their agenda in terms of legislation, maybe the first 2 years, but they don't get everything. And that's the thing they're trying to say here. Everything you hear, don't count on all of that being implemented. Number four, there is big macro impacts that, depending on the outcome of government, whether it's a unified government, let's say one party dominates the White House and Congress, or it's a divided outcome where you have a mix. Maybe Trump gets reelected, the Democrats hold on to the House, the Republicans have the Senate, and they're going to, in this policy paper, they kind of map out what that would look like under each scenario. And then finally, they talk about, all right, given the outcome of either candidate, what sectors of the market would do well under either candidate and which ones would be harmed. And that was pretty much it, Chris. They were taking a look at it. Like I said, it's probably the most comprehensive thing that I've seen about the election. But this is probably, at least in my lifetime, one of the key and most important elections in my 40 years in the business next November.
Well, it seems like there is a lot to lose or gain, depending on how you're looking at this election. But that first takeaway, Jim, where they mentioned that elections have consequences, they surveyed 645 investors about what their expectations are for the investment impact of the 2020 election. And there were a couple of interesting things. They talked about fiscal policy and tax changes. You'd expect them to talk about that. Most investors expect the election to have a significant impact on their market outlook. But the thing that really struck me was it said that the election's impact on the business cycle may be more important than its impact on the most recent policy risk to U.S. markets. And here's the part that got me. It said that investors see Democrats as de-escalating tariffs with China, which, in their view, would boost near-term growth expectations. So that sounds really good. You know, elect a Democrat and see near-term growth expectations because of their approach to tariffs. But then it said investors also are more likely than not to associate a Democratic victory with an equity market sell-off. So, Jim, what's your take on that? Because it's kind of looking at both sides of the coin. If Democrats are elected, good. If Democrats are elected, bad.
You know, the idea that they would de-escalate the trade tariffs, you know, and this is a lot of the debate that you're seeing on this trade war between the U.S. and China. China is taking a look at, they're trying to impeach the president. So if you were China, you'd probably say, you know what, we would probably get a better deal under a Democrat. They would be less harsh on us, whether it's technology theft or outsourcing, whatever it is. And the one thing that we know, and our economists on this show have talked about it, though, the area of the economy that's strong right now is the consumer. And 70% of the U.S. economy is consumption. The ISM service sector is doing very well. The ISM manufacturing sector is not doing well because of the trade uncertainty. So basically what this policy or what this what Morgan Stanley is saying, investors view a Democrat would de-escalate the trade tensions, so therefore businesses would be better off. I don't buy that because if you take a look at the other stuff we're going to get into, I do believe they would de-escalate the trade tensions. That I do believe to be true. In terms of the economy taking off, I don't, because I think the other things that they're proposing would actually be harmful to business.
Well, and the second point they make was really interesting to me, because when they say that reactive is better than proactive, they mention that candidates move markets, but that they react with a view on total government outcomes and fundamental impacts. Well, you'd intuitively think that being proactive is the right way to go. But in this study from Morgan Stanley, they're saying that reactive is better than proactive. They say, don't play for the swings. We think it's better to prepare to react with a view on total government outcome. What's your take on that, Jim?
You know, I agree with it 100%. I mean, just take a look at how much presidential tweets have had an impact on the market. Or you will hear, and this I think you'll see more next year than this year, is as it begins to become clear who the candidate is going to be, then they'll start looking at policies. And then when they give a speech and they say, if I'm elected, I'm going to do this, I think you're going to see more reaction in the market to those comments. Right now, it's sort of in the background other than President Trump's tweets, because he is the president. So when Trump tweets and says something and has more meaning in the market than a potential candidate on the Democratic side, because they're not president. So, but I think as we get closer towards the conventions next year, when we have a clear-cut candidate, and we're going to get into each one of these candidates here in just a moment, but I would probably agree with that at this point.
In the Morgan Stanley report, Jim, they talk about proposals from some of the key candidates, the candidates that they feel really have some kind of likelihood of being elected. What stood out as being really interesting about some of these proposals?
Some of them, quite honestly, Chris, are quite scary, but they took the 10 top candidates, and I'm really only going to talk about Warren, Sanders, and Biden, because when you look at the other candidates, they're only polling 1, 2, 3%. We've already seen several of them drop off, and I suspect as we get into the first quarter next year, it's going to boil down to these three, although Biden right now is having trouble raising money. So let's talk about what they would do, and let's talk about trade policy. All of them would support the goal of challenging China, but they would change the approach, and that's the same for Biden and Sanders. They would be less supportive of challenging China, the executive, that would be Biden. They would support various trade measures. In other words, they're going to be a lot easier on China, which is what Morgan Stanley said. Hey, if they're a lot easier on China and a lot of these trade tensions go away, that would be positive for the economy. And that's pretty much across the board, whether it's Biden, Warren, or Sanders. Now let's talk about healthcare. Here's the big one. And Medicare for All, that would be Sanders and Warren. Now, Warren has finally outlined her plan, and it's basically rich people pay for it all, and it would cost about $52 trillion. Medicare for America, none of the candidates followed that. The next thing you would have is Medicare buy-in, and now both Sanders and Warren would be for that, and government authority to negotiate drug pricing. In other words, all drug pricing in this country would now be controlled by government, almost like price controls that you have in rent, and that would be Biden, Warren, and Sanders. Now, here's where the big damage to the economy comes, and that's in taxes. Raise top individual tax rates, limiting deductions for top bracket filers. That's Bernie Sanders. Raise capital gains taxes. That would be Bernie Sanders and Biden. The raise the corporate tax rate. Now, that's interesting. None of them. Now, create a wealth tax. This is really Warren and Sanders. In other words, every single year, there would be a 3 to 5 to 7% annual tax on your wealth. So it would start out, I think Warren's would start out, Sanders would start out at $32 million. And I'm trying to think if it's Warren would be $50 million. But you would pay an annual tax of 3% every single year in addition to your income tax. There would be a 7% additional corporate tax imposed on any company that made $100 million or more. All three, Biden, Warren, and Sanders, increase the estate tax. That would be Bernie Sanders. Increase Social Security taxes on upper income earners. Now, right now, Chris, this year you pay Social Security taxes on the first $132,000. Anything over that, you pay a Medicare tax that could be up to 3.9%, depending on your income. Now, what would happen under Sanders and Warren is they would tax upper income individuals. So you would pay the 15.65% tax on all your earned income, in addition to the federal taxes. Repeal Trump taxes, that's pretty much all three of them. Value-added tax, only one candidate. Increasing personal tax credits, that would be Joe Biden. Additional Medicare for illegals, that would be all of them. Then infrastructure spending, that's more Bernie Sanders. Financial regulations, this is the one that scares Wall Street. That would be Biden and Warren. They would bring back Glass-Steagall. They would reduce the consumer cost of banking and private equity overhaul. Basically, what Warren and Sanders want to do is tax any kind of transaction on Wall Street. It would be a 0.5% tax on anything you buy, 0.5% tax on anything you sell. Then they would have regulation of tech companies. Warren and Sanders would break up the tech companies. Think Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. And here's another big one. Energy legislation. Boy, this would be a big one. There would be a carbon tax added on tax and trade. There would be stricter EPA regulations. That's both Warren and Sanders. They would end all new oil and gas leases on federal lands. That's all three. Banning fracking. I mean, that would virtually end the shale boom. That's Sanders and Warren. They would support the goal of clean energy. Support banning fossil fuels. They would end fossil fuels. In other words, get rid of oil and gas completely. That's Sanders and Warren. Finally, they would raise the minimum wage to $15. That's both Biden, Sanders, and Warren. Cancel all student loans. That would be Bernie Sanders. And support eliminating the filibuster, which would be Elizabeth Warren. So those are mainly the main categories of what they're proposing. And like I said, we only took the top three, which was Biden, Warren. Although this race could change, it's been announced this week that Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire worth about $50 billion, said he may enter the race because it's so crazy, the stuff these people are proposing. And Bloomberg said he would spend $100 million of his own money. I mean, he's worth $50 billion. He could spend $1 billion, probably not notice it.
And in fairness to the report, I mean, they do mention that it doesn't mean that investors should assume these policies would actually be implemented if their party takes control of the White House. And they note that post-election policy tends to conform more in direction than precision to a candidate's platform. They say that the party is moderated and constrained by the makeup of Congress. But when I read that, Jim, I thought, well, man, that doesn't seem to be the case with Trump. He is really checking off his list of campaign promises. he seems to be more conforming to precision rather than direction. So still, Leon Cooperman had something to say about how the stock market would react if Warren or Sanders is elected.
If Elizabeth Warren is elected president, in my opinion, market dropped 25%. Bernie Sanders, same thing, you know, in my view. Because as I listened to the debate last night, I kept on thinking of a great statesman by the name of Winston Churchill, who said, you don't make poor people rich by making rich people poor. He said, the main vice of capitalism is the uneven distribution of prosperity. The main vice of socialism is the equal distribution of misery.
So, Jim, as we talk about how a particular candidate may impact the market, depending on where you stand politically, you may have a different perspective, but Bill Gates had something very interesting to say about one of the very popular candidates running for president. Let's take a listen to that now.
You know, I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes. But I, you know, I'm glad to have paid, you know, if I'd had to pay $20 billion, it's fine. But... you know, when you say I should pay $100 billion, okay, then I'm starting to do a little math about what I have left over.
Well, given what the Morgan Stanley report has to say, Jim, and also given the fact that we're just under a year away from the election, what are your key takeaways, Jim?
You know, I think next year is probably going to be the dirtiest political campaign we've probably seen in our lifetimes, Chris. I mean, just look at the way things are playing right now and polarization in the country. But I think we're going to see 2020. I think it'll still be a positive year for the market, given a couple of things. Number one, the consumer still remains strong. So if unemployment remains low, wages are going up, and consumers are spending, that's going to be a positive for the market, and especially the ISM service sector. Those two things tell me this economy will not be in a recession. Now, that's barring something we can't see. But let's talk about the negatives. Democrats are hoping the impeachment process will carry on and damage the president's chance for reelection. So we have impeachment, we have the trade war, which still hasn't been resolved, and we have an outright war against Trump by the media. I've never seen the media hate somebody as much as they hate this president. And then we just got this week, this could throw a wrench into everything, especially this could probably impact Joe Biden more than the other two. And that is Michael Bloomberg basically saying he may throw his hat in the ring. So we'll have to wait and see in the next 2 weeks if he registers in various states, whether we take that serious. But, you know, those are the things I think 2020 is going to be. It could end up being a positive year for the market if, we have central bank stimulus. I expect more Federal Reserve rate cuts. So that's the Fed. You got to remember, the Fed's injecting $60 billion of liquidity into the market. That's going to be positive for the market. If the economy is still growing, that's going to be positive for the market. But, you know, it's just like the market reacts to tweets. The market's going to react to political news. I don't care if it's impeachment or God knows what comes next. So I expect it to be a volatile year.
Well, and Jim, with you expecting it to be a volatile year, anything we should have our eye on or expect?
You know, Chris, I think the impeachment, they're going to have open hearings next week, so the market will be focused on that. But, you know, when you really, as I say, this is probably, and one of the reasons why Morgan Stanley probably came out with this report, it's probably one of the most impactful elections of our lifetime. I mean, you have, if you want to summarize it, socialism versus capitalism, globalism versus nationalism. I mean, one thing you can say about this president, as you pointed out, he's ticked off just about everything on his campaign promise, but Trump is known more so as a nationalist than he is a globalist. And so I tell you, it's everything that we're going to be looking forward to. I mean, it's pretty straightforward and clear. The Fed will be probably cutting interest rates, probably the market's factoring in at least another one or two rate cuts, either end of the year or the beginning of next year. The Fed has already said it's going to be pouring $60 billion a month into the market. They're basically going to undo QT, and they're going to do that all the way up to the second quarter of next year. That should be positive, but it is going to be volatile, plain and simple. There's just no way around it. There's just going to be too much in political theater. And that's why I think what Morgan Stanley was basically saying, be reactive rather than proactive, because it's anybody's guess in which way this thing can turn out. It could be a thin red line, a blue tide. It could be a red rideau. You just simply don't know what the outcome of this election year is going to be like. And that's why they're basically saying, you know what, it's kind of like, reminds me almost the Fed, we're data dependent. We are political dependent too as well. And that's the way I think it shapes up for next year.
Well, what do you see coming up on the more immediate horizon?
Well, on the immediate horizon, it's going to be political. Once again, Chris, they're going to have open hearings for impeachment next year. So it's going to be a media circus for the next week or two. So once again, politics is going to be dominating the markets. We'll just have to stay tuned. Nothing pretty much on the earnings front. We're pretty much through this earnings season. Regarding the Fed, they're basically going to say, we're going to wait and see. Although if we were to get some weaker numbers, let's say a weak start off to the Christmas season, hard to believe we're entering the holiday season. You may even see a rate cut coming as soon as December. But if the economy remains on track, probably rate cuts, we probably won't see that to next year. But right now, everything is going to be focused on politics over the next 2 weeks. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here. If you can get a copy of the Morgan Stanley report, it's definitely worth reading. Points out, I think they did a pretty even-handed job of treating both sides, positive and negative, and what the outcomes are going to be. It's a great report and well worth a read if you're an investor. In the meantime, until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.